did you actually spend trying to get this published? I know we've been talking for a couple months now. How long have you been working on wrapping this up? Because I know it's been a journey.
Well, so it started as part of another paper. I don't know if you had a chance to see the James Davies, Brian Peace paper. I included it in my thread about this one. It's Beyond the Psychedelic Hype.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's mostly focused on like neoliberalism and the way that like neoliberalism is doing the same thing with psychedelics as it did with SSRIs. But mm-hmm. yeah, just as I was this, I started out writing a section of that paper. And then as I realized how much there was that was in this direction, mm-hmm. I decided to spin it out in its own paper. So yeah, and just the proofing process took really long because it's the paper is so long. It's like, you know, like almost 12,000 words. So it's really hard to proof things that are that long because it's easy to like miss.
Mm. Totally.
I didn't want to work that hard on something and then have it marred with like typos.
Right.
And
stuff. Yeah.
so that just like I had an early experience publishing something that like I was like, oh, I really wish I just put in the extra time to like double check everything. So now I try to do that, which that kind of made it take longer just because I've been so busy that I didn't have time to like proof it for at first.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, because especially when you get the end to like 12,000 words, your brain's just mush. You're lost in the sauce. You have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. No. And then there's another aspect to it too where I would end up, because of getting lost in the sauce and you just getting, you know, I would end up getting a corrected proof back. And then as I was double checking it, I would see all this other stuff that I had missed and I'd be like, oh no, like, can I please change things again? So, but luckily they were actually very accommodating with multiple rounds. Like it was technically like, you have one chance to revise, but they were totally open to my additional revisions.
That's cool.
Love a good editorial team.
Yeah. You're listening to the TripSitter podcast, where we demystify substances, break down the science behind them, and discuss the crazy world of psychedelic culture. Like having a TripSitter watch over your experience, our goal is to provide guidance and support in preparation for your psychedelic journey. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the trip.
I'm Rowan Zioli. I'm a contributor for TripSitter.
I'm Justin. I'm the founder, editor-in-chief of TripSitter.
And I'm James. I'm also a contributor at TripSitter. And today we are joined by a person that I have followed for a long time. If you've read any of my articles, there's probably a 5 to 10% chance that one of their papers is cited in it. You might know them from past research reviewing the patient journals from a big psilocybin and smoking cessation study, which I think had major implications personally on the way that we research psychedelics. They also were a co-writer on a big paper called Right Wing Psychedelia that is also one of the biggest papers, I think, in psychedelics right now. Today, they are here to talk with us about a paper that I think it would probably be fair to say is a culmination of a lot of other work that you've done. To be fair, you are cited several times throughout it from your past research, too. So I think that would track. We're here today with Dr. Neshe Devineau, you're a senior lecturer at Johns Hopkins. Is that your title?
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah. So thank you. Tell us a little bit about this paper and about what you are trying to bring to light with it.
Yeah, well, thanks. Yeah, it's such a big paper that, as you say, like touches on a lot of other ideas. So it's a little hard to figure out where to start, but I'll just mention for starters that part of what was like the genesis of this project was actually watching the discourse around like AI unfolding on Twitter. Like this is very much a Twitter response paper, you could say, because it's like watching the discourse of people talking about things kind of gestating on implications was what kind of led to everything coming together. I do cite Twitter posts and stuff in the paper, but specifically I was interested after ChatGPT blew up and became a big deal and all this buzz around generative AI in particular. I was noticing that there was a lot of parallels between the critical AI scholar community and the critical psychedelic studies community. I was seeing similar arguments unfolding, and I actually started posting like, hey, this sounds a lot like what's going on with psychedelics. And in particular, there were some critical AI folks saying things like, it's not the AI in general that is the danger here. It is the AI plus capitalism and extraction that is the problem. But I was seeing, because I've just dealt with, as someone who has been in the psychedelics field since 2010, I've seen historically, I think this is actually changing in part, you know, as reflected by the positive responses I've gotten to this paper, but historically, there's been a lot of resistance to critical perspectives. And in particular, there's been a kind of recurring idea that this success of the movement is very fragile and people have been working so hard to get to where we are today that we can't ruin it for everyone, you know, but like, let's just like not air the dirty laundry and all of, you know, the rest, because there's this like, we must protect the movement kind of emphasis. But similarly, I'd seen a lot of people dismiss critical voices in the psychedelics field as, oh, they're just prohibitionists, they're just anti-psychedelic. And that's part of why I did a talk at Breaking Convention this past summer called You Can Be Both Pro-Psychedelics and Anti-Hype, because I felt like it was really important to like name that, because I was seeing confusion about like conflating the anti-hype perspective with just being anti-psychedelics. And like, no, like I think psychedelics are fascinating. It's super interesting. It's the combination with capitalism that is the problem.
Nuance, crazy, what a concept.
Yeah, your paper is kind of touching on this weird phenomenon where people seem to think that it's like capitalism is always bad unless it's with this. And in this case, it's really good and it's helping. And I wondered if you could maybe just start from a high level, break down what Task Real is and the ideologies that I know that it's kind of like a grouping of several, but what's the commonality that groups them together?
Yeah, well, so there's a few parts, I think, to the answer here. First of all, the Task Real acronym came from the discourse around AI in particular. It was coined by Timnit Jebru, and who was famously fired from Google due to her work and concerns about ethics and technology. And then Emil Torres, who's was originally embedded in the ideologies that were described by this acronym, but then kind of realized that there was a lot problematic with it and so has been speaking up. What I really appreciate about the acronym is that it's an interrelated series of ideologies. The acronym itself names roughly like the chronological emergence of the ideas. And so it's transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. And in my paper, I cite both Emil and Timnit's work, but also there's a brief piece by Dave Troy in the Washington Spectator that very briefly summarizes each of the different terms in a way that I think is really helpful and accessible. But the main concepts that I focus on in the paper is this arc from the beginning to the end, linking transhumanism to effective altruism and long-termism. And just in brief, the idea here, and this is something, you know, I was noticing a lot of parallels with a lot of the discourse amongst the psychedelic funders. While they're claiming to be about pro-social and pro-environmental aims, their behavior is working in actually the opposite direction. The way that they're building systems around psychedelic medicines in particular is indicating that things are moving in the opposite direction from these pro-social, pro-environmental aims that they're claiming and actually citing to justify why it is that they're building this, these systems out the way they are. But with effective altruism and long-termism pointed out through especially Emil's work broadly, prior to even the acronym coming together, there was a great piece on long-termism, I think in Eon. But the idea is that there's this group of philosophers out of Oxford University that really articulated a way of viewing the world that just coincidentally justifies the preferences and priorities of the elites.
Just by happenstance.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
As like the best way of going about things. And so unsurprisingly, they have been lavishly funded. And this actually gets to an idea that in the book Winners Take All, there's a footnote in my paper, and Anand Giridharadas in that book talks about how the thought leader type of ideas that get on the stage at places like TED and become, you know, catchy and financially supported tend to be these ideas that are beneficial to the existing power structures. So it's like the people who are the most wealthy and powerful are not the problem. The simple answers in terms of like taxation and addressing inequality directly are never on the table. And there are these other ideas that get a lot of stage time that are reinforcing, oh, actually inequality is right and good.
Yeah.
So effective altruism and long-termism in effect are these science fiction tinged philosophies that are like, we need to get off planet. We need to get focus on the well-being of future billions of digital consciousness minds uploaded to supercomputers distributed across galaxies. And numerically, there's more of those future consciousnesses than are people and animals alive today. And so it justifies, you know, that priority is actually not just better, but all of cosmic history and evolution has been building to a point where it's now possible to actually jump ship and transcend the physical world that we've historically been confined to. And, you know, in the most extreme versions of this narrative, to not do that, you know, all of history was just a fluke and a dud. And this potential, this cosmic potential was never actually achieved. And so that's on us now, you know, because we had this opportunity. And so on the AI side of things, these scholars have been pointing out in all the headlines about AI risk and extinction, and this is something Emilio Torres talks about, it's not actually human extinction in general that's the problem, because human extinction is the goal of developing artificial general intelligence. Because it's like, we need to move beyond the human. The only problem with things like climate change and near-term extinction is we might become extinct before we've made the jump off planet.
Right.
So what I think my contribution is to the Tescreel literature is pointing out how psychedelics are probably exacerbating billionaire confidence in these science fiction narratives. So it's like the psychedelic field has something to add to these conversations, because I think it's making the problem worse, even on the AI side of things.
Yeah.
Oh boy, that was so intense. But like, I think it's so essential to this kind of idea as well that you touch on, is this like co-opting of this language of equality. They're like, no, we're doing this for the betterment of everyone. Like, we all deserve this.
Right. I really feel like that has allowed a lot of this to fly under the radar. And that's why I have, you know, I probably would have had a smoother move to my new job if I hadn't have been working on this so intensely over the summer. But I really felt, especially as all of the stuff was going on around the MAPS conference and the Indigenous protests, like it was right as I was finishing the paper. And I was like, oh, this is like, this is exactly what I've been talking about. And so it just slid right in the end to kind of encapsulate everything. But I mean, because the gist is that there's all this talk about Indigenous reciprocity in this field. When you look closer at these ideas, they're actually completely incompatible with Indigenous reciprocity. Genuine reciprocity is not just about giving money, like donating to Indigenous causes. It's about taking the worldviews and ontologies seriously and respecting those. And you can't have a relationship between this desire to transcend the physical, material world and to transcend the human and use the entire living ecosystem of the planet as fuel to that end. You can't combine that with ideas about all life is important and valuable and interconnected and embedded with the material world and the specifics of our location. Like, those ideas can't coincide. But superficially, for people who don't have a lot of experience really diving into what these funders are talking about, it might sound like, oh, long-termism, like this is focused on the betterment of future generations, and that sounds compatible with Indigenous ideas of, you know, act in ways that benefit the seventh generation, these ideas about like an honorable harvest, conservation, and mutualism. It sounds maybe like it could be compatible, but when you look deeper into it, they're actually completely diametrically opposed orientations. And so that's why when all this stuff goes on around MAPS and you have Christian Ingermeyer on a stage. I didn't talk about this in the paper, but Rick Doblin of MAPS and Christian Ingermeyer had like a fireside chat. And then there's, you know, an Indigenous protest described as like with a hug at the end and, oh, this is an opportunity for growth and we're bringing all these threads together. And it's like, no, actually, these are things that cannot be brought together. But it's something that I think without having the time to delve into it, you don't necessarily see that. And so I was trying to write the paper for people who just haven't had that opportunity to really kind of have some clarity about the stakes of what's going on here.
Before, you were kind of mentioning how the ideas that get stage time, the ideas that people get to talk about, are these like really simplified ideas that are diametrically opposed. In your work and like with this podcast right now, how do we make these incongruencies and like what we should actually be doing a little bit more accessible to the general public? Because that's who's getting influenced by this propaganda, not educated people who are in the know to a degree.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I mean, I tried to write the paper in a fairly accessible way, like in terms of like conversational sort of language. There is some like jargon terminology, but I tried in general not to, you know, to have it read in a way that you didn't have to have like a specific disciplinary background for most of it to kind of follow along. So I think talking about a lot of this stuff in a straightforward way can be helpful. But also, I mean, historically, like I was saying, the critical side of psychedelic studies has been very much marginalized and excluded from conferences and conversations. The people who tend to be lifted up who are describing critical perspectives, oftentimes they're a little bit recuperated. The sharp edges are sanded off and they're presented in a way that is accessible and compatible with the dominant ways of doing things, as, you know, kind of repeating this pattern again.
Oh, this isn't a great system, but it's the one we're in and we gotta work within it.
Yeah, and pointing towards these like possibilities of reconciliation where reconciliation isn't actually possible, but you can say, you know, oh, we can all get along here. These are all like, it's just a matter of having a few more conversations to iron out the differences. But actually, no, like there are some incompatible ideas and there are goals and aspirations that are moving in completely opposite directions within the field that people just haven't, I think, fully acknowledged.
Yeah.
But in terms of like what do from here, part of what I was interested in at the end of the paper is making a case for more cross-discipline, cross-community collaboration, because although within psychedelic studies, the critical psychedelic study side is a minority, mm-hmm. and half of that minority has been written off for various reasons, you know, and isn't even incorporated into the conversations within the field. That same problem is going on with other fields like AI, where it's like the well-funded institutions are not the critical voices overall.
Right.
So even though we're minorities in our respective fields, I think there's a lot of opportunity here to join together. And so like I was saying, as an example of what psychedelic studies can bring to this conversation is like, oh, likely these billionaires are having these grandiose experiences with psychedelics that's fueling their confidence in these science fiction fantasies about the evolution of consciousness. That's one example of how like all the different fields and pieces of this puzzle like, have important parts of the conversation, pieces of a larger picture that we don't have in isolation from each other. So I think in the future, being able to work with people who share certain operating assumptions like capitalism is bad actually, but are working in superficially different fields can actually start to put their heads together in a way that hasn't fully happened yet.
Yeah, there's this feeling I got when I was reading. You go into the long-termism pretty in-depth in the paper too, which is a really fascinating concept that I never really thought about before. The way that it struck me, at least, was exceptionally enticing if you're wealthy, because it's essentially the ends justify the means, and I get to determine what those ends and means are. And it's okay as long as I offset it in a way that I determine makes it okay. There's not really, you know, like if you're trying to talk about deforestation, how do you offset that unless you just plant another forest? I wonder if you feel like there was, we're calling this the psychedelic renaissance because it's coming back. Do you feel like this was a similar kind of vibe for the earlier psychedelic movement in the 60s and 70s? Or do you feel like it was less so that way? I mean, now we're trying to kind of medicalize, and back then we were trying to more militarize. But, you know, do you feel like the tendency to use it to persuade the masses while simultaneously broadcasting it as the solution for the problems that you're causing? Is that something that has always followed the psychedelic experience, or do you feel like this is a new thing in line with the AI and technology movements that we've had?
It's a good question. I think that a lot of what's going on now has roots and continuities with previous development of psychedelics in a Western context. My PhD is in comparative literature, and I'm working on a book project right now looking at psychedelic literature and analyzing it. And one of the books that I look at is Timothy Leary's High Priest, which is a pretty interesting literary autobiography that kind of goes over his introduction to psychedelics and his work at the beginning of going to Harvard and then leaving Harvard and Millbrook and everything. But the reason I mention that is there's a lot of interesting material there about Leary having this expansive, interconnected experience in Mexico and then coming back and being really confident that all he had to do was give psilocybin to whether it's inmates or, you know, other people through his research at Harvard. And that was just going to address like a lot of these problems, these same, you know, it's going to make people not want to be violent. It's going to make people be more empathetic and, you know, care more about things. But at the same time, each of the chapters, like, there's a lot of really dark stuff that emerges, a lot of violence and power plays and aggression that is not fixed by the confidence in the substance. So, you know, I think the disconnect between the kind of panacea, like, you know, this is like a magical cure for all of our problems, with, like, actually there's a lot more nuance here and potential to amplify darker tendencies, like, that has been going on for the whole time.
Right. Yeah. There's a quote in here that's like, we know the solutions to climate change, right? Like, we already know what it is. We just, it's too systemic for us to do it.
I think there's this connection in the paper. You mentioned this idea of hyper-individualism and how it all kind of feeds back into this individualistic nature of capitalism, and how the answers come from within us fixing ourselves. As opposed to, like, you can take these psychedelics and suddenly every systemic issue that you've ever faced is solved. Mm. I don't know if you got the opportunity to see the creativity privilege thing that people were referencing with the AI conversation.
What's that?
So there was a tech bro, of course, who was like, actually, the reason why AI is good and stealing from artists is good is because there's some of you that are creatively privileged and you had the opportunity to work on your art where we didn't have that opportunity. And so it's leveling the playing field. And I think psychedelics have a similar idea in a lot of these people's minds, where it's like empathetically privileged, maybe, like, you had the idea to be able to have empathy and connection to other people. And there's this idea again of co-opting this language of inclusivity and progression for these individualistic capitalistic ends.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and AI famously only uses art from people who weren't impoverished, right? It's like exclusively scrubbing SEO content on websites and free artwork that people have digitally uploaded online. You know, like you say in the paper, it's siphoning the wealth from the masses and funneling it to the wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point about the co-optation of the language of liberation and pro-sociality and pro-environmentality, like, that these are rhetorical strategies to persuade people that this is actually in their interest to get behind. But then, as you said, not only is it not fixing the root causes, which is inequality, and this is something I mentioned in the paper, it's like the specific things that, you know, the psychedelic thought leaders and psychedelic, you know, the AI people as well will say that these tools are going to fix: the rise of fascism, the political polarization, increasing rates of depression, environmental degradation. Those are all linked directly to inequality in society. So not only are we promising the solutions to things caused by inequality, but then the ideologies of this Tescreel bundle is actually moving in the exact opposite direction. It's justifying widening acceleration of inequality, because it's only by concentrating the wealth in the hands of the elites, who are the only ones who have the awareness of this off-planet goal combined with the ability to marshal the planetary resources to move in that direction, that we can actually do that. And so it's a matter of trying to persuade people, or, you know, prevent people from, you know, undermining that off-planet goal is behind a lot of these big funders in both AI and in psychedelics.
And I think what you were speaking to before about this idea of needing to come together from all these various fields and various disciplines, of how that itself is going against this individualist idea of, like, you can save the world if you take psychedelics, you can save the world if you use AI, when actually it's like, necessarily being critical of these ideas and of these tools to come together and be like, why aren't these things fixing the problem? How do we actually fix the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I really think that you're mentioning something really important there. Part of what I was trying to do with the paper was not just talk about these ideas as an individual, but really gesture towards the strength in community, whether it's through collaboration or other ways of working together with people. And I think that is a great contrast with this sort of, you know, great man philosopher ethos, or, you know, the individualistic responsibility, because we're the only way we're going to address these systemic causes, especially because the resources are so stacked in favor of the already wealthy, is through things like solidarity and mutual aid that I think are essential to psychedelics in the first place. I mean, this gets into something I don't address in this paper, but I've been talking a lot about. The hierarchical model of psychedelic-assisted therapy is where I am seeing, my colleagues are seeing, especially colleagues at Symposia, whose work has really informed a lot of my thinking around these topics, A lot of the harms that we're seeing are interpersonal harms that are exacerbated by the power differential of like a therapist or a guide or a shaman, especially when they're purported to carry some kind of sacred spiritual wisdom that they are bestowing upon you, which happens in a lot of kind of more culty or under some underground contexts. So right now we're at this disconnect between people being told by the popular media, especially encouraged by people like Michael Pollan, who I talked about this in an earlier paper, Dark Side of the Shroom, where he really insists upon these hierarchical models of access, where you have some kind of paternalistic leader that's introducing you to the substances. But a lot of the discourse currently says that that's the only safe way to experience psychedelics is by having a trained doctor and a therapist or some kind of guide. But when you're going to a faraway place, you're traveling to see a stranger who's putting out a shingle and offering some kind of expertise, that is overall, in general, I think that there's situations where having a therapeutic context might be helpful for people. But for the average person who's interested in psychedelics, I think it is much safer in general to be with people you know, people you're in community with, providing mutual aid and supporting people. You know, one person might sit with, you know, a friend and let them focus and go deep on their experience and then trade off and vice versa. Being able to support people you know and in our community with, I think that that is overall for the average person much safer. And yet that's not the way that the mainstream of the field is talking about psychedelic access. So it's just another example where the possibilities of mutual aid are not as much on the table.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know how pharmaceutical companies are going to be able to charge for your friends hanging out with you. But once we figure that out, I bet we could get there.
Exactly. I think what you were saying, Dr. Devineau, about this idea of how community, in every instance, every single problem that we have is solved by community. From climate change to poverty to inequality, by like seeing each other as people and recognizing that like the people first approach over the profit first approach or over the medicalization first approach, all of these like, oh, we're thinking about people long term for consciousnesses millions of years in the future, but like what about the people right now? Focusing on how we can tangibly help people in that way. We have a lot of interviews that we just lined up talking about this very thing, and it's so interesting how at the core of all of these things, always, time and time again, is the people that you care about also care about you, and you just gotta take care of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is a really good transition to I thought, the wildest part of your paper that I had never actually heard of before, which was that there was a ketamine service offering free doses to specifically blue-collar workers who were laid off from their tech jobs. And I just want to go ahead and say this line about it, and then I'd love to hear you kind of explain a little bit more. But it says, instead of medicating the distress from job loss with ketamine at wellness clinics, highly paid tech workers could join unionizing efforts to push back against the disposability of labor and join in solidarity with the lower paid, precarious gig workers in which these industries depend.
Love applause. Applause for that line.
So this example of the telehealth company giving it specifically to blue collar workers and restricting it from, you know, someone who just can't afford it per se. I think that that's one of the most obvious examples of the like trickle down psychedelics that you're talking about, where it's like, I think there was a quote in here that was like, even if only wealthy white people take it, it'll help, which is a really beneficial thing if you're a wealthy white person. But can you talk more about other examples of ways that that is trying to be implemented and the reasons why it's not helpful?
Yeah, totally. And so that what's so interesting and challenging about talking about these ideas with psychedelics is that there's a lot of interrelated forces here and perspectives that are feeding into and playing off of each other. And that's part of why I start out talking about MAPS and their like Grafian approach to healing, their philosophy of healing, because I think like that perspective on how psychedelic therapy works, for example, feeds into these other kinds of hierarchical, non-coalition-based, non-solidarity based perspectives on addressing problems in general. So the field trip health example, Ronan Levy is one of these figures who just says outlandish things that I think he's not even aware of. That a lot of the stuff, you know, Christian Angermeyer is another example where it's like, there are things that I feel like if people had more self-awareness and insight, they would not be saying out loud, like, you know, and let alone recorded, because then people like me are going to analyze them and put them in our papers. But there's this common idea, and this is actually, so Jules Evans recently wrote a paper about evolutionary spirituality, which has a long history in psychedelic communities and philosophy in general. But there is a common view that you just have to treat and persuade and change the minds of the elites or the people who have the most power, because they're the ones who are going to be able to steer the ship. I mean, you see echoes of this in Aldous Huxley's belief that, oh, we should have been giving the psychedelic stress to like the politicians and the artists, the kind of cultural elite and the political elite, because the masses don't really know what to do with this. They don't have the background experience to like make proper use of these tools,
which is like a deeply prejudicial belief,
right? Yeah. No, totally. There's all kinds of eugenicist, racist, ableist, you know, ideas underlying all of the terrestrial and like a spiritual evolutionary spirituality perspectives, but through and through there is this idea, even that you see very commonly in the psychedelics field, that we just need to dose people like Elon Musk and people who have the power, because once they care, they'll be able to use all those resources to benefit everyone else. So really, they should be the focus of our attention and priorities. But that's actually reproducing a lot of the same problematic thinking that has gotten us into this problem to begin with. And we can be doing things like reinvesting in communities, removing the huge power differential between like labor and capitalists, and giving people more say and agency in their lives, you know, rather than doing the same top-down approach and trying to solve things that way.
This is that idea of a trickle-down ecstasis, I think you're talking about. And in your paper, you're talking about how it's debunked by trickle-down economics theory. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so trickle-down economics is a line that has been said for a long time to justify why the wealthy shouldn't have to pay taxes, essentially, because it's like they're the job creators. They're the ones, it's the same kind of idea that they're the ones who, their choices can benefit everyone. It relates to like even the founding of the United States, how, you know, only landowners could vote, and this like protection against this perceived tyranny of the masses, that only the elite actually have the constitution to be able to make good decisions.
Right.
That highly racist, highly classist, sexist idea has for a lot of people contributed to why they don't want to allow people to have comfortable jobs who are on the lower side of the class differential, because if they are to have that means to change the world, they'll do it badly, you know, like that kind of idea. But actually, Rutger Bregman, I think his name was, he was the one who went, I don't know if you heard about this, he went up to Davos and spoke in front of all the billionaires and said, like, you want to improve the world, how about you pay your taxes? Like that, did you all hear about that? So he's also done a really great TED talk about, like, people point to poor, stressed out people making bad decisions to say, hey, they're in that bad life situation because they made bad decisions and because they're not like constitutionally capable of making better decisions. But he pointed out, like, actually poor people make bad decisions because they're stressed out to no end. Anyone under those less harsh of life situations would not be able to plan ahead and think clearly and optimize all aspects of their lives because they're just drowning.
Yeah.
Their house is on fire.
Quite literally, actually, in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
And so that consequence of the problem is pointed to and used to justify the ongoing system of the problems. But these kinds of ideas are, you know, most of the people in the psychedelics field do come from very privileged backgrounds. And so they'll hear ideas like that of like, oh, I just got to where I am because I worked really hard and poor people must have just like not worked very hard. And so those kinds of ideas tend to be able to circulate wider because there's not a lot of class diversity amongst the mainstream of the field. So ideas that to me, as someone who like came from a more challenging background, are preposterous on its face. Other people who just haven't experienced what life is like when things are really hard just kind of like think, okay, yeah, sure, this might be a plausible way to go about things. And that's part of why you need diversity of perspective, because you need to incorporate the perspectives of people who have struggled, because then you don't realize where you're not seeing clearly and you're just in an echo chamber of people who have also led very privileged lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. You were speaking to the Elon Musk of it all and the trickle down of it all. A weird little fun fact that you might appreciate. My roommate has a source for an LSD lysergamide kind of derivative that Elon Musk uses as well. And he described it as a feeling of hyper-productivity and low empathy.
Perfect.
He did not get this sense of, like, connectedness that he normally gets with other psychedelics. That it was like, oh, no, I want to work right now. And if that is the echo chamber that they're feeding into as well, of like, oh, this is what psychedelics can do. It can make me more productive, which I think is the goal of a lot of psychedelics and AI. This idea of like you can heal yourself to become more productive because of the inevitability of capitalism and the structure that we're in.
Yeah,
and that on that point about like productivity aids, in the same kind of journal issue as the Test Girl paper, there's another paper with James Davies and my symposia colleague Brian Pace, Beyond the Psychedelic Hype, that talks about some of this focus on productivity and how that kind of just feeds into the same capitalistic for-profit structure of everything. So there was a wild article I saw this past week that I don't know if you've all seen it, but it was associating psychedelic, it was one of these survey studies where they're like kind of plugging numbers, and they associated psychedelic use with fewer overtime hours worked. Have you seen this?
Oh, awesome.
Perfect. I was thinking of right, posting about this because it's like close reading the whole paper. The paper about the article that came out is wild. It makes these claims like, well, when you scale this up and let people are working fewer hours, is this going to fuel a quiet quitting approach to like not working as hard? But they were like, but maybe people who take psychedelics are just more efficient and harder workers. And so they don't need to actually work as many hours to get more done. And there's no like fact behind that. It's just pontification, thinking within this sort of efficiency-based like perspective on things. And that's just In an ideal field, to me, that kind of idea would not just be shared and circulated and like clapped about. It'd be like, cite your sources, please. Like, why are you making these claims?
It might even question, like, is productivity the thing we should be aiming for?
Yeah. Just so, I don't know. You used the term when you were talking about the net zero trauma promise, that it's a theology. It's not based in anything. It's just a faith. You only know the world that you live and that you allow yourself to be exposed to. And it's one of those things that we don't really think about, because these kinds of thought patterns are very common in all of the wealthy, I feel like. Or not all the wealthy, but a lot. And it's certainly a lot of the wealthy in power. And it's because a lot of them really boil down to, how do I justify exploitation, it seems. And you realize that a lot of people just never think outside of their own life.
Totally. Well, I mean, there's some, you know, it's just speaking of like the theological motivations to some of these ideas, you know, there are some people who really believe that your work in life, like, is to kind of follow through on the karmic consequences of your decisions. Mm-hmm. And so if we make things easier for people that need to be struggling to kind of like deal with their fallen nature, we're taking away their opportunity to self-actualize and evolve out of that.
Yeah, they have to learn on their own, right?
Yeah, it's like there are people who really, they have such an individualistic idea. And this is kind of common in certain aspects of evangelical culture, where it's like, you're going against God to make things easier for people, basically. And it's like, it's not actually in their interest for you to take away the thing that they need to become better.
Right. There's so many mental gymnastics to justify just horrific viewpoints and just try to like figure out how to make yourself right in the way that you are, instead of trying to like figure out how to fix the problem and move forward. And I feel like antidepressants and SSRI link between psychedelics and those as an option really are so similar in that way, because depression, as you know, is not necessarily a chemical imbalance, right? Like there's all these social systemic factors that go into why you're depressed. And SSRIs came out and they were like, we're the pill that gets rid of depression, you know, and we're finally done with it. And there was like all this celebration, like depression's over. And then obviously that didn't happen. And then now psychedelics are doing the exact same thing, especially ketamine. I see ads all the time on Facebook that are like one dose and cured, you know, and it's like just insane language that we're throwing out there for no reason. What do you think is the healthy way for us to try and talk about the things that are happening and that are exciting about psychedelics? You know, the introductory studies are really exciting a lot of times, but how do we roll this out correctly, or is it even possible with the system we have?
Yeah, well, there's so many things to talk about in that direction. One thing that comes to mind, so I was working with my friend, colleague, Rafael Lancelotta, who is applying sort of a liberation psychology lens to psychedelics. And they were walking me through some of the history of like liberation psychology. And I really think there's a lot there in terms of like, rather than just viewing things like depression as an individual brain problem, part of the approach to liberation psychology and part of the way that you kind of move through and process suffering is to identify systemic connections and then kind of like work towards mutual aid and solidarity approaches to addressing those as part of reclaiming your life and moving through those issues. And so I feel like there could be a lot of benefit to incorporating psychedelic perspectives. And that's something I've talked about with David Nichols at Symposia as well, where he's mentioned his background, like his initial kind of introduction to psychedelics was crap, like realizing the fractal embeddedness of the effect of capitalism and all of these systems on individual experience and drawing attention to like what Alan Watts has talked about as like a figure ground reversal, where instead of like seeing things the way that you usually do, you flip it and you see things from this systemic lens. That could be part of deconditioning from hegemonic, capitalistic, neoliberal forces that have structured your subjectivity since you've been a small child. And then we're asked to do things like sell yourself on a, you know, college admissions essay, present yourself as this kind of constantly entrepreneurial subject, as they talk about in the neoliberalism kind of context. So we have all of this baggage that we've just kind of accumulated that we assume to be who we are and what the world is, but it's actually consequences of capitalism and legacies of colonialism and all of these issues. And so I think that the most exciting potential applications are those systemic awarenesses and looking beyond the priorities and preferences of the elites to actually how can we not accept these Tescrillist explanations and actually work together to resist the accelerating inequality that we're otherwise moving through.
Mm. Thank you. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Sorry. Taking that all in. This is really wild to me. There's this part in your paper about Angermeyer and how he is proposing a new diagnosis for fear of the future. And I'm just going to read the quote here. Psychedelics generally help people to move forward into the future in a positive way. Psychedelics can enhance creativity and improve neuroplasticity, two essential abilities we need to be successful with this transition, such as making ourselves open to new models of living and new job opportunities. So, you mentioned that this is essentially the same as Soma and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, this idea of using psychedelics to make people more complacent with whatever they have to do to further whatever cause we deem to be worth it. Outside of this obvious quote from Christian Angermeyer, how blunt do you feel like others have been with that? How common has this been coming up?
I haven't seen any more overt examples from Angermeyer. Like he is like the farthest and like most mask off with that orientation.
Right.
But you see shades of that with the people who are convinced that conscious psychedelic capitalism is the way forward, because it's like they're kind of committed to a certain view of what psychedelic medications are going to do for society and building things out in a certain way. And so it's just a matter of, you know, some people are maybe not understanding why that's the best way. And so psychedelics could like help people to be more open to this thing that they're convinced is true and right and the best way forward. So you see things like that quite often. There's this commitment to a certain vision for the future that psychedelics are kind of like opening up for humanity. That's very common. But Angermeyer is like the most like overt, because he's an out and out like transhumanist too. Like he's explicit about wanting to get beyond the kind of confines of the human and extend consciousness in all these different directions. And so when he says fear of the future, you can hear that as like resistance to the Tescrillist direction that we're going. And so you just have to, the idea that framing that as anyone who doesn't agree just doesn't get it. And psychedelics can help people be more open to this thing that I know is true and right. You know, that's quite common in a general sense. But I haven't personally seen anyone beyond Angermeyer be that overt about it.
I guess like another like somewhat more abstract example would be the potential use of MDMA in active duty military. and the idea that we can cure them of their PTSD and get them back out there kind of thing. But that's also a little bit less overt.
Yeah, well, and people talk about that in different ways. Like, there are some people in, like, a Black Mirror-esque way where we just have to kind of scrub away the vestiges of, like, empathy and kind of, like, get people to just move past, don't register trauma, just keep killing, like, that kind of perspective on things. There are other kind of more nuanced perspectives, but you do see that risk of just making better, more efficient, less destabilized killers, which is obviously disturbing.
Yeah, just a little bit. But I think also, like, tying it back to this idea of liberation psychology that you had mentioned prior, a core tenet of, like, liberation ideology and, like, this abolitionist idea that a lot of people have is the necessity of imagining new futures. And I think psychedelics and AI have a lot of capacity to help us imagine new futures. Maybe not AI, because AI is kind of, like, self-feeding, but psychedelics, certainly. This capacity to imagine new futures and new possibilities as opposed to new ideas within the constructs and confines that we have.
You know, right now the whole push is on individualized treatment with psychedelics. And I've wondered a few times why we don't really do any studies on group psychedelic therapy at all. Can you kind of speak to why we've taken such an individualized approach with our clinical research? Have we tried before and it didn't work out well, or?
Well, there has been recently some group therapy studies. And I think there is actually more and more interest in that because of the potential to reduce cost, which is something that, you know, capitalist approaches is very
I was actually thinking about the potential to reduce the likelihood for, like, sexual abusers and stuff, but I guess the cost makes sense as the reason why they're actually looking into it for research.
Yeah, I mean, well, you do see lots of abuse happening even in, like, ayahuasca contexts where there are groups of people, that so it's not like having a group ceremony actually protects people in general. And in fact, there's been all kinds of ways that the field has tried to quietly kind of set up situations that are less likely to lead to abuse, like the male-female co-therapist dyad, but that's, you know, abuse is still happening. So it's like, to actually address the issue of abuse, we need to deconstruct rape culture and patriarchy, be more expansive in teaching about consent and the, you know, interpersonal harm reduction, you know, from early ages. We have to address it kind of, like, head on in that sense, I think, to really get at the problem. But in general, you know, I think that there's been just historically, there's fewer variables if you have, like, just a person and a dose, you know, there's more interpersonal variation in terms of, like, you know, the people in the room can influence your experience. So historically, science has been, like, you know, trying to reduce variables to try to focus in on what's the effect of the psychedelic, for example. But there definitely are group experiments going on. There's more and more interest in that direction as well.
And I think speaking to the idea of, like, we have to disassemble rape culture and patriarchy to get at this, like, why are these happening in these spaces that are supposed to be progressive and supposed to be healing? It's because the people facilitating it are still in a hierarchy, are still in this, like, I am a doctor, you are a patient, I have power over you. When you don't maintain and don't bring in those ideas of, like, we are two people in this space, that there have to be specific boundaries and specific expectations, you get just the rehashing of these same cycles of trauma over and over and over again. And so I think it ties back to, like, what you were saying before of how all of these systems of power are interconnected. And, like, you kind of got to just start pulling at one of them before you go, we're going to fix all of them at once. And that is work that is done. Trauma that happens in community can only be, like, healed in community.
Can you just say more about what you were saying about the pulling on one thread at a time?
Yeah. So I think, speaking as a trans person specifically, the issue of transness and racial power and, like, I am a white trans person, and so that is something that I have to, like, deal with within my own community. I have to pull at the thread of white supremacy and patriarchy and ableism and misogyny. Like, literally just pulling all of these threads individually and having to do that work internally, individually, prior to coming into a psychedelic collective space and being like, I have the answers to heal things. Because I think everyone goes through this idea of, like, you take psychedelics and you have the secrets to the universe. But those systemic issues still have to be done and pulled out one by one. Did that answer your question, or do you still...
Yeah, well, I was just trying to understand how that differs. Because I do hear a lot of people say, like, you have to do the work yourself, and that kind of, like first before you can help others. But I've seen that narrative misused in a way to, like, distinguish between people who have done the work. Adjacent to Jordan Peterson's idea of, like, you have to clean your room before you try to, like, create change in the world, that sort of thing. So how does what you're saying differ
from... I love that you're questioning my... I genuinely...
Awesome. That is the coolest thing that'll ever happen on this podcast.
That makes me so deeply happy. I genuinely... That's a great question and a great thing to confront it with. For me personally, in the ways that I have navigated the world, the things that happen on psychedelics heighten these individual systemic issues and have only been healed in community. And so I'm actually just talking my way around this, being like, what do I mean? And I think that's also, it's really important, like, for people listening to this podcast right now, the, like, ideas that we have gone unquestioned, we need to kind of deconstruct them and think about them. Because I think of myself as, like, a very leftist, like, I label myself as an abolitionist and anarchist, and I have these ideas that I think are very central to what we're talking about, but I've never thought about that before. Like, I've never questioned, like, how is it different from what Jordan Peterson says? And I'm gonna now, like, spend the rest of my day thinking about that. How do you think it's different? Or how do you think it's not different, rather?
I don't know. I've just, when you said that, it reminded me of things I've heard, you know, like very white fragility, kind of DEI corporate, take this workshop so that you can do the inner work, which, you know, a lot of interesting diversity theorists have criticized that perspective of, like, you just have to pay for these workshops and do this, like, internal process of disentangling, you know, all of these discourses. And it can end up, in terms of, like, some of the critiques of that perspective, recapitulating the same individual work kind of ethos, that individualism that kind of, like, drives some of the problems.
I think I figured it out. I think it's that these things don't exist in polarity. These things don't exist in mutual exclusivity. You are not just an individual or just a community. You are an individual in a community. And so doing that work with other people, like, yes, it's internal work of idea of, like, okay, how am I unpacking my own preconditioned ideas of capitalism and white supremacy and patriarchy within the context of my interpersonal relationships with other people? It's not like I'm isolating myself and thinking about these things in theory, but how do my actions reflect these theories I have in my head, or how do they not? And how does that work conflict? Yeah, truly, I'm going to be thinking about this for the rest of the day, if not the week.
Well, I teach writing, so it's, my job is literally to, like, notice places that, like, huh, like, this idea, like, could be mistaken for this thing, and, like, maybe this could be unpacked a little bit more, and that sort of thing. So, and that actually relates to, you know, the disciplinary hierarchies, because I think, like, just related to what we were saying before, being able to envision a future alternative world and the power that that brings with it. It really emphasizes, like, the value of storytelling and, like, literature, and as something that's really important and an important part of these larger processes and possibilities for psychedelics. But, you know, in this example, you know, just being a writing teacher, you know, a lot of people would consider that to be, like, less than a PI in a psychedelics lab. But I think that there are really differences in terms of the ways that different life experiences and disciplines notice things and ask questions that are really valuable to all bring together. But there are these very, like, regimented academic hierarchies, you know, that influence the circulation of ideas in the psychedelics field, like, for example. But just on that point related to, like, Jordan Peterson, like, he uses that sort of idea as a weapon. Like, who are you to critique kind of capitalism when you can't even keep your clothes ironed? Like, that sort of thing. And it's like, come back once you're every speck of dust is gone from your room. And it just kind of, like, serves as this way of keeping people from ever trying to change anything, because there's always more that can be done in your immediate environment. So yeah, I definitely didn't think that you were saying that, but I was just kind of interested in the echoes, the potential echoes to some of those ideas that I've seen misused.
I think that's, like, the double-edged sword of existing in this, like, very theoretical space that we're in, is how we've been talking this whole time, this co-opting of language, of how, like, there's so much nuancing with these ideas, and when you bring them into the public sphere, when you're trying to bring these ideas to a larger number of people, you don't necessarily have the time to sit down and have an hour and a half conversation with them. You have these little sound bites that you put out into the world that don't contain all of the nuance because of this social media economy that we're in, and people take that however they want. And I guess this circles back to, like, my very first question of, like, how do you, in your work, because your work is very accessible for academic means, but still for, I think, for the average person, it's a little bit harder to get into it. how do we convey these ideas in an incredibly nuanced way, in a way that people will respond to, that doesn't take up an hour and a half podcast?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the full context of long-termism is inherently a bit esoteric, like just because there's so many sci-fi backstory pieces to what it is that they're envisioning and moving towards with funding AI and the psychedelics industry. So, you know, the average person, I don't know how interested even they would be in all of that, but I do think that challenging some of the talking points, the dominant talking points that people like Michael Pollan have been happy to kind of promote, like, you know, you need a guy not so fast with decriminalization, like those kinds of things, like just not going along with those kind of talking points and saying, like, actually, most people who work in the field of psychedelics, like, not gotten to the field from experiences in clinical trials, like, right. A lot of people, especially in the early days, like they had individual experiences with their friends or they knew someone who had had an experience, but it was not in the context of a therapeutic trial or anything along those lines. So being willing to speak up and acknowledge that the emperor has no clothes with a lot of these perspectives and that there are very basic, simple, alternative approaches to thinking about the ways that psychedelics can interface with society. And this is something I haven't talked about publicly yet, but I've been working on. It's kind of related to your question. I've been working on a kind of an analogy between a mutual aid approach to psychedelic experiences with what's it called? Freediving. But so free divers, it's a sport where you hold your breath and you try to dive really deep into the water. And when you hold your breath for a really long time, it produces like alterations of consciousness, you know. Your cognition and your attention and things like that change as you're diving deep and trying to come back to the surface. And it can be a dangerous sport because especially oftentimes when people are coming back up, they will black out underwater and people have died that way. And so what the freediving community has done is that there are safety divers or support divers who are not some spiritual guru who has some secret knowledge that you can't ever access directly, but they're people from the freediving community who will serve in support roles for other people when they're trying to achieve depth, you know, hit a depth that they haven't, you know, is an effort for them. And what the role of the support diver is, there's a number of things they do ahead of time. They have practiced hand gestures so that you're able to communicate without talking underwater. They are familiar with all the techniques of like reviving people and to kind of first aid, trained to recognize when people might be having a hard time and might need some support. They're also trained to help people relax. You know, if they come back up and they've had a stressful situation, they might have blacked out or were running out of air and are now a bit freaked out. They're trained to help with breathing and other kinds of ways of regulating the nervous system and calming down. They can help with any kinds of equipment involved at any point in the trip out there. And so similarly, I think a model of kind of using these analogies from other fields, like a model of guides not as outside experts, but just people in community who just are serving in that kind of support role for people, and that people can switch out when it's like, you know, maybe someone wants to go deep, whether it's with DMT or whatever else, and having someone there who can, you know, get you a blanket and water and hold the glass vapor genie or whatever else. And also people in community with you. There's an early story by Shayla Love in Vice where she was talking about going to, I think, Synthesis or some retreat in the Netherlands to try psilocybin. I think it was psilocybin therapy in like a group context. And she said when she was coming up, she was having a lot of anxiety and stress. And the person who came over was like trained to like aggressively sage her with like smoke. And it was the exact opposite of what she needed. Like she was feeling overstimulated and stressed out and was like, but the person who was trained of like, this is how you guide, is if someone's having a hard time, you sage them. But if you're in community with people who know the kind of music that you really like, that really helps calm you down, puts you in a good vibe, they can know what to put on. They can better read your body language to say, you know what, maybe the sage today, not a good idea. These kinds of basic things that I think it's like the system that they're building in the dominant mainstream way of doing things. If we need these experts to put out a shingle and invite people into their homes far away from where they actually live, that is like uniquely amenable to abusive people who want to have power over others. And this is something I've talked about a lot as well, kind of drawing connections to other fields. It is related to your question of how do we communicate some of this. Over and over again in different fields, we see that people who are drawn to abuse people and exert power over them will create life circumstances and careers where they will have access to a steady stream of supply of people who they can mess with, whether it is the Catholic Church, Boy Scouts, the United States gymnastics team. Over and over again, this happens. We know that psychedelics are uniquely attractive to this type of individual because you can have this sort of spiritual, charismatic power over people at a time when extremely vulnerable people are specifically flocking in desperation to be healed to this area. And the barriers for entry are so low. We have MAPS's Rick Doblin saying, you shouldn't even need a bachelor's degree. When the reason that there's training with therapy is partially the positive content of this is how you go about being a therapist, but it's partially the oversight of, are you safe to be around people who are vulnerable? And so by having like race to the bottom in terms of oversight and training, including in like how to respect boundaries and understanding consent, with all of these certificates that are going out that you can like pay $5,000 and you get to have your shaman certificate and now you can use that and go out with people. It's as if designing a system that is built to funnel the most vulnerable in society into the hands of predatory people. We cannot be building systems that only work if you have good intentions. Like, that's not going to be realistic as this is scaling up and getting to be more and more of a big field that people are interested in. So it's just like all of these things. Like, I really think that there are elephant in the room, simple solutions for dealing with the problems. Those solutions happen to not be the most profitable and the most able to kind of like give the type of lifestyle that people want. Because like a lot of people see this as their opportunity to start the unicorn company, to be the CEO, to be the expert guide. And the guide in industrial complex is leading to preposterous ideas. Like, people have bad trips because they don't set the right intentions. Pay me at the flat fee of $599.99 to like program your intentions to so that you're not going to have a difficult experience. And it's in people's interest to kind of present things in that way, because it's like they get to be the ones that come in and they have the expertise and they get the kind of reputation as the rock star in the field. But in reality, we don't need any of that. And that's actually a more dangerous way of doing things than just giving people access to information.
I think that that's a really good landing point, unless anyone else has any other questions. I wanted to know before we go, though, like, say, what does the Dr. Neshe Devineaux utopian psychedelic future look like? We're 100 years in the future and we've done everything right. Where does that leave the industry?
I don't think there would be an industry.
That's fair. Yeah, there we go. That's the right answer.
It's all a house of cards, ultimately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yes, there's interesting science that can be done. Yes, there's a potential for therapy to be, you know, to me, that's an open question still. And we didn't get into my Johns Hopkins qualitative paper, but because like, earlier you mentioned that, you know, these early studies are quite good, but there's a lot of issues with the early studies.
Oh, so totally.
We do know that people, like, I have had a life-changing experience. And so, like, I know firsthand that they can be beneficial, but the specific ways that they're going to be beneficial, in what context and to what ends, all of that is still an open question in general. But I think that the kind of escaping from this profit-focused, optimization, work-focused uses. I mean, I'm really interested in the creative potentials of, you know, being able to make poetry and art and like communicate aspects of these profound experiences outside of the context of the chemicals and isolation and that sort of thing I'm personally interested in. And also just like, yeah, using it as a tool for solidarity towards collective liberation. I mean, that would be preferable to me than an industry.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm there with you. Yeah.
No, that's great. That's the right answer. That was awesome. Okay, so obviously, go and read Tescreel Hallucinations, which I believe is on your Twitter or X or whatever it is, at Neshe LSD.
Yeah, and that's my actual initials too.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Perfect.
NESELSD is my handle on most platforms.
We'll link it below too.
Where else can people find you, or what else can they read of yours?
Symposia, I really recommend checking out. I came to the psychedelic field having grown up in really difficult circumstances and had this experience that changed my life and made me able to function in ways that I was not able to function previously. So it's like the fact that I was able to go and like give talks and that kind of thing like spoke to how profound the experience had been. Mm. But then this field that I was told was all about healing and addressing trauma and pro-sociality and all the rest, like I just saw so many predators, so many people complicit with predators. And, you know, and then when people like me would speak up and say, hey, like, this is a problem, that there are people running conferences who are sexually assaulting people and that kind of thing, a lot of the field, because of some of the topics we discussed earlier in terms of like, we have to protect the movement, was like willing to look the other way.
Yeah.
And during those difficult years, like recently, my profile has kind of changed to a point where, you know, a lot of people are now taking me seriously. But for some years when I was like unemployed and really struggling, Symposia was like the group that really had my back and was, you know, kind of like helping me to develop some of this analysis, even when it was not kind of like cool in the dominant, the dominant field. So I would really recommend checking out Symposia if anyone isn't familiar.
Definitely. Yeah, I love Symposia. I think I've linked them a couple of times in a couple of different articles, but I'm a big fan of the work that you and everyone is doing over there. It's, I didn't know that backstory beforehand, but that just makes me like them even more. That's awesome. Is there anything else that you want to share on the topic today before we close out?
Just want to say thanks so much. I guess maybe one more thing. I mentioned that, you know, a lot of people, just the humanities, like, aren't taken as very seriously, and like, you know, things like writing and not taken very seriously. Like, I actually quite enjoy being underestimated a bit. Like, it's kind of like from having this, like, I appreciate the perspectives that I have from being outside the dominant field and in areas that like other people don't take as seriously, because I, you know, I'm just kind of looking down and doing my work and kind of following my nose on things that I was like, there's something here that's worth kind of thinking through. So I really am very intentional about the work that I do and how I write it and kind of matching the form and the structure of my ideas to the ideas that I'm trying to communicate. But I don't have a lot of people to like talk to about that and appreciate that. So I really appreciate that you reached out both about the, because just as some backstory, you were like one of the first people I sent the paper to, and it was because you were mentioning the Hopkins qualitative paper and being surprised that there wasn't more like talk about that paper.
That was devastating. That, like, because I remember reaching out to you and I was like, there's no way that Dr. Devineaux is going to have time to get back to me. There's probably like podcast after podcast lined up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was devastated. I didn't see you everywhere after that.
Because I do think there's something quite interesting in that paper in terms of like the implications for the field. But I was like, oh, if you like that paper, there's another paper I'm working on that you might be interested in. And that was this test grill paper. But just long story short, like, I really appreciate when I do have an opportunity to talk to people who value these kinds of approaches. And, you know, I'm happy to just do my work and kind of keep trucking on, but it's always really great to be able to talk to people that are also interested in kind of exploring these perspectives. So thank you very much for reaching out.
Omar, thank you. This is like the only kinds of conversations that I want to have. This is like one of the highlights of my career. So definitely the pleasure is all ours. We really appreciate you coming along.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, I'd love to stay in conversation.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the TripSitter podcast. Don't forget to check out Dr. Devineaux's most recent paper, Test Grill Hallucinations, Psychedelic and AI Hype as Inequality Engines, which you can find through her Twitter handle at NESELSD. TripSitter depends on the support of our viewers. If you'd like to help us keep up the work we're doing, head over to tripsitter.substack.com, where you can subscribe to receive even more premium content. Want to show support without a monetary requirement? Like and share this podcast and give us a rating. It really does help boost our listenership and would mean a lot to us. Our Substack also has a free subscription option, which sends out twice a week, and you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky if you need some more high-quality drug content. This episode of the TripSitter podcast was hosted by Justin Cook, James Gordon Curtis, and Rowan Zioli. James also produces this podcast and edits it with help from Ronito Villamore. Thanks, Ronito. Remember, no drug is inherently good or bad. They're just chemicals, natural or unnatural, that exist in the world. It's our relationship with them and how we interact with them that makes the difference. Until next time, have a safe trip.